Elvis and his sons and grandsons are examples of professing Christians who did horribly, horribly unchristian things. Clovis, the king of the Franks, 466 to 511, the founder of the French kingdom. But the fact is that God used this kind of thing in bringing about the conversion of a major part of Germany. First, God offers the gospel. When it's rejected, then they're conquered and defeated. And then it's offered again. And people are sincerely converted and become missionaries. In the next generation, it really takes hold. As Germany had its Boniface, so Scandinavia had its Ansgar, a man by the name of Ansgar, who did the same kind of thing in Scandinavia that Boniface had done in Germany. A-N-S-G-A-R. He lived, he was born in 801 and he died in 865. Notice we're creeping on through the medieval period. He was called the Apostle of the North. Boniface was called the Apostle of Germany. Ansgar was called the Apostle of the North. Jutland and Denmark were converted as a nation in this. Ansgar was born in 801 and died in 865. Jutland and Denmark were converted by the year 1027. Sweden and Norway were converted by the year 1019 and 1033, respectively. Cyril and Methodius were two brothers who went to minister to the two blood brothers who went to minister to the Slavonic tribes. And that's a thrilling story, too, and one that I hope we can go into a little more in detail later because it has to do with the evangelization of Russia. And incidentally, Russia is a nation which, as far as I can tell, there's not been any reformation in. I have a friend, Theo Savru, who is probably one of the world's ranking authorities. He teaches history up at the University of Minnesota today. He is a Christian man. His wife's a Christian man. We saw them start into Indiana University. You would remember them, Yuri, down there, Theo and Frida. And he is confident that that Reformation has yet to come to Russia and that it will come. He's very clear about saying it'll never come from missionaries sent in from the outside. It has to come from Reformation of the church inside. And he's confident that that will take place. And I hope that we can go into that, Methodius and his brother, and how it was that God used them in the development of the gospel in Russia. Now I want to go on to the, you want a break right now? Is this a good time for a break? I want to go on to the subject of the Holy Roman Empire and then monasticism, which is where we'll finish this evening. This is probably a good place to break. Let's break for 15 minutes. Now, there is a conference going on upstairs right now. It's the Reformation Translation Fellowship Board, and they are meeting in the porch room upstairs. So please be careful of them. But otherwise, the whole building's available, isn't it, Michael? Yes, as always, it's available. Good. Is this other tape in here?
Yes.
Thomas Aquinas?
Yes.
Where is it?
It should be right in front of that box.
Oh, here it is. Here it is. Do we have any handout on it?
No.
I don't think we do have. That all of you know about a plan, a program, a mission that is being planned at this time. There is a considerable interest in a study mission to Scotland, and we are in the act of preparing for that, getting together some costs on that and a time for that and how much time there could be in that. It looks now as though it would be not less than 2 weeks, not more than 3 weeks, and as though it would be, what dates did some of us sat down with a map and some other things, and we're looking to see when that could be best carried out, just before this class here today. What were the dates, Robert, that we were talking about there? The 28th of May on through into June. And it would be 2 to 3 weeks. It looks as though it would be costing, for costs alone, of about $1,500. And we're thinking about a group of about, 24 people. We could handle more than that if we needed, but we would have to shift gears and do something more than that. So we're saying at this point that we're looking for 24 people. Been a number of people have already said, I want on that. It will be a study tour. We will be studying maps before we go. I prepared a bibliography, a descriptive bibliography, that goes all the way from novels, historical novels, to some geography, and also some bona fide history and biographies, and then some theology that would be important for you to know about and to do some reading in before we go. We'll let you know more about that, but if you are interested in that, please see us right away. And we'll... did those need to be on? Would that help if we unplug those?
Turned off, reduced the load on the breaker.
Could you do that, Mark? Here. I think here. It probably would look a little bit better without all those lights on me up here anyway.
What about the Journeys of Paul? Is that still in the works?
The Journeys of Paul is they've not set any dates for that. Jerusalem University has not set any dates for that. But that would be sometime in May. And it's quite possible that those could be back to back. We would be visiting points of Reformation interest, and because of that, and the fact that there are going to be several dates when we're not going to be able to meet here on Friday, as we come in December, towards the end of the year, I will be carrying over these lectures, Medieval Church History, into the new year. And we'll... put these up here on the board in a little bit. Next week, we'll be working on the Iconoclasts and Hildebrand and the Crusades. And then on the 14th of November, the papacy versus the Hohenstaufen and the Eucharistic controversies. And then 21 November will be the midterm exam. The 5th of December will be the Schoolmen, the Sects, and the Mendicants. The 9th of January will be the Schoolmen and Mendicants, German Mystics, and the Babylonish Captivity. Then the 16th of January, we'll go right back into this, the Great Councils, the Latin and Greek Churches, the Revival of Learning. 23rd of January will be the Life and Work Christian Art, Waldensians, Wycliffe, the Lollards. The 30th of January will be the final exam. Then we will go immediately into Scottish Reformation history. That'll begin the 6th of February and carry on through until May. Now, the dates towards the end of May will be not as certain as the ones here. I want some flexibility here. But this will be generally the content and the direction of where our lectures are going. All right. Let us know if you are interested in those in that tour of Scotland. I've been asked to lecture over there on Scottish church history and theology beginning the 22nd of June. I don't intend that this study mission would revolve around those dates. This study mission would come before that, and then I would just simply hold over for that afterwards. I want to go on now into the Holy Roman Empire. And I'm putting the word holy in quotation marks as we come to it. What were the dates for the Roman Empire? I want you to orient yourselves mentally in terms of the time frame. What were the dates for the Roman Empire?
I suppose you could, you know, bit of that controversy when the transition from the Republic to the Empire, but I'm going to say about 63 BC or so, on up until the sack of Rome. After that, things were pretty disorganized for the 4th century.
What were you going to say, Mike?
I think he said 63 to 410, 63 BC to 410.
About 60-some years before Jesus was born. Then to 410 after he was born. The Roman Empire was in existence, of course, you remember, when Jesus was born and when he lived. And then in the years after that, ancient church history that we covered in the last class. The Roman Empire was in full swing through those years. This covers up to about the time of the beginning of this class, 591. A little before that, the Roman Empire was in its demise. What are the dates now? Go ahead. What are the dates for the Holy Roman Empire?
I'm really going out on a limb here. I'm going to say somewhere around 800 A.D., was official clear up into about the middle of the 1800s.
All right. There are certainly ramifications of that. I had from 800 to 1500, 1590 probably, because those were the dates that I was sort of fixing in that outline of history of the church that I'd arranged before. But this is good. This is good. I want you to think the way these men were thinking here. When I bring up the Holy Roman Empire, now wait a minute, how's this oriented? What's the time frame? You've heard Russ asking that same kind of question. Please use your timeline to help you be oriented in terms of the times and the thinking. How then are these two related? The Roman Empire and now the Holy Roman Empire. What does the Roman Empire have to do with the word holy? I've told you before about the Lombards. They were a Germanic tribe. And incidentally, do we have that map for a moment that we could look at this? And keep this in mind. Just as you oriented yourself in terms of times, keep yourself oriented in terms of geography a little bit here. See, this is Italy over here. This is Lombardy. And these were the Lombards who were constantly threatening the Pope and Rome. Before that even, when there was just a bishop of Rome, Gregory was threatened. And in generations before Gregory, the Bishop of Rome, the Lombards were threatening down through there. The Papal States are down here. There's the Adriatic Sea, there's Corsica. And the Franks, you see where the Franks were coming from. And then the Saxons on up there, and Friesland over here. And this is the Kingdom of France over here. Kingdom of Bohemia. And these lines are not, they keep shifting and changing, but I just sort of keep that in mind as we go along here. Now we can go back to the outline. I've told you about the Lombards several times, a Germanic tribe that established a kingdom known as Lombardy there in northern Italy, and those were from the dates of 568 to 774. 200 years or so. Capital was in Milan. They were a constant threat to Rome and the Bishop of Rome, and they often besieged Rome. The Roman bishops tried to get help and protection from, where would you guess?
Constantinople.
They would try for help from there, but the East was too far away. What was the East preoccupied with? The Turks, the Mohammedans. That's it exactly. And they were also too much interested in images. And what particular kind of images developed in the East? Terrible, terrible war over those. Icons. To them, they're not just pictures. Icons have the character of the person who is depicted. And you still see those icons on the altar and the churches, all those churches, Russian Orthodox churches, all those Orthodox churches face east. And then up north, at the front where the altar is, then you see those pictures. But they're not just pictures to them. And They were preoccupied with the Mohammedans, and they were concerned about their icons, and the Western Church was opposed to those icons. The Western Church was in favor of images, which the Eastern Church opposed. And there's a development of a real battle here, and I'll have a whole lecture on that a little bit later on when the... Patriarch of Constantinople cast a curse on the patriarch or the ruler of the bishop of the Church of Rome and vice versa. Yeah.
I'm missing something here. The Eastern Church has icons and the Western Church has images. What's the difference? They both seem to violate the Second Commandment.
We'll work on that a little bit later on when we get over into the iconoclasts. We'll work on that. And yet the iconoclasts came up with some very excellent arguments here. They said, yes, there was a time when that second commandment had to be interpreted and understood. They said it was still in effect today in the Christian church, but it had to be interpreted and understood in what the situation was before God sent his son into the world to be seen by man. And Jesus said, of course, he that has seen me has seen the Father. And I'm just telling you their argument as to how they defended themselves on the subject of icons. And some of the ones in the West then tried to defend themselves on the basis of images. It's that same way. So the bishops of Rome looked for help from other sources. They were being pressed by the Lombards and by others. They looked to Constantinople. Constantinople was too busy and too much opposed to them in other ways. So the bishops of Rome looked for help from some other sources, and they found it in the Franks and the rising political empire. That is far more than what we mean by France today. The Franks were a Germanic tribe that settled in the Rhine River area. And as I said before in the earlier lecture, they were named for the kind of lances that they were very adept at using in battle. And actually, at this particular point in their history, they had a lot to offer each other. The "they" I'm referring to there is Rome and the Franks and the rising political power of those Franks. The Frankish kings needed just as much help from the Roman bishops as the Roman bishops needed help from the Frankish kings, because the mayors of the palace, that's what they called the actual rulers of the Frankish towns and districts, mayors of the palace. They had suffered long under do-nothing kings. They wanted a king who would really rule and who would take them someplace. But you don't just set aside a hereditary monarchy that has been in place for many, many generations. They were stuck with a hereditary monarchy, and they didn't know how to do anything about it. They needed the ecclesiastical sanction of the church and the highest congregation or ordination, consecration or ordination that that church could pronounce in order to make someone king, a real king. So, in 752, Pepin, P-E-P-I-N, the son of Charles Martel. Who was Charles Martel? Who had he? What had he done? He had broken the back out of the Muslim attack that was coming up from North Africa across the western end of the Mediterranean Sea into what we now recognize being Spain and France. It wasn't that then, and he had stopped them. Up to this point, they'd been unstoppable, all the way from the east across Africa, where they became known as the Moors, and then up into Europe, and he was unstoppable. But Charles Martel, now here's the son of Charles Martel, and he is the father of Charles V, and this is where we get involved in all these Charleses. So if somebody would make a chart of all the Charleses, it might be very helpful for all the rest of us. But this Pepin is crowned king of the Franks by an old friend of yours, Boniface. Who is Boniface? The apostle of Germany. The man God used in a tremendous way in setting up and organizing the Christian people in Germany. He is actually crowned king of the Franks by Boniface of Germany, who did it in the name of the Pope. He deliberately crowned him, but he said, "I'm acting in the name of the Pope," from down in Rome. And from that day on, King Pepin made the cause of the church, whether it was Boniface in Germany or the Pope in Rome, he made it his own personal cause, and he would do anything that they needed. Well, you could see how that would provide an answer for the need for protection that the Bishop of Rome, now the Pope, had. The Lombards missed the importance of this act, and they provoked another war with Rome in the year 755, and King Pepin drove down into Italy and whipped them. He rose to the defense of Rome immediately. Later, in 774, Charles V, Charles the Great, really beat the Lombards when they made the mistake of attacking Rome again. Now, this bringing together of the political and the ecclesiastical, state and church, was a very important fact in medieval history. It threw the civil government into the hands of the Roman Catholic Church. Some would say that it threw the church into the hands of civil government. But I think we're going to find that it was the other way around. When Charles V began his career, he had the title of Patrician of Rome. Patrician of Rome. The Pope had given it to him. given that title to his father, Pepin, out of gratitude for the rescue that he had effected. He had driven down there and had rescued the Pope, and so the Pope declared him to be the patrician of Rome. And then when his son became the king, Charles V, he too became known as a patrician of Rome. Charles was known as the new Constantine. Remembering now the Roman Empire, the old Roman Empire? Charles was known as the new Constantine. And Charles kept conquering more and more land from the Lombards. Remember where they are, parked up there at the head of the isthmus that is Italy? He kept conquering more and more land from them and then giving it by donation to Rome. And that word donation is a very technical and important word. That was the origin of the political state, the temporal dominion of the Church of Rome, sometimes called the patrimony of St. Peter. Let me just pause for a minute here and put a parenthesis in this. Is Rome today a political state? Go ahead.
Far and away, the smallest and dinkiest state with which the United States has ambassadorial relations.
And who appointed that ambassador to Rome?
Reagan.
One of the most dangerous things. I very much like many of the things that President Reagan did. But that was a very, very dangerous thing that he did. And I objected to that, and he didn't listen to my objection. Russ was just saying that the Pope in Rome has had a very tremendous political influence in many of the nations and much of the international politics of today. And we may see that as being a small operation, but it has had a tremendous impact. And it's all the more dangerous because of that. I just wanted to call your attention to the development of something that we're still dealing with today. The Lombards had taken it from the Greeks, and now Charles is taking it from the Lombards and giving it to Rome. But here's the $64 question. Was he giving it back to Rome? Had they ever had it before? You're right. But why did you shake your head no? You're right. All right, the Church of Rome said that Constantine had donated, had given a donation to Rome, and that all these lands that Constantine had owned, or most of the lands that Constantine had been given originally to Rome. Now, years and years later, the document that was supposed to have been the final legal seal and on all that were declared even by the Roman Church to be forgeries. Not true at all. But back here, they were talking about giving it back to Rome because in those days, the medieval times, they were saying that Constantine had given it to him, the Franks had taken it away, and now here comes Charles along and he's giving it back to them. That's why they use that phrase, giving it back to Rome. Yes.
Is there any truth to the story that Pepin was given by somebody from the Pope a letter that was supposedly from St. Peter and he fell for it?
I don't know about St. Peter. But he had seen the letter supposedly that had been given by Constantine.
So supposedly one from St. Peter.
I don't know about the one from Peter. I don't know about that. But that kind of thing was being done. That kind of forgery was quite common in those days. And you could imagine when writing wasn't as much in evidence as it is today, that a document that had been written and supposedly signed would have a tremendous authority. I wouldn't be surprised about this. I don't know of this, though, that Peter himself had given this land to Rome. Well, Charles conferred these lands on the Pope, and the Pope was to hold them of the king. Now, remember, the king held his crown of the Pope, and the Pope held his lands of the king. And we're just talking about church-state relationships. Absolutely no indication that Charles ever intended to set up an imperium in imperio, is what they called it in Latin in those days, an empire within an empire, a state within a state. We need to be careful about that today. Who owns the geography that has been deeded to the Roman Catholic Church in the United States today?
The bishops.
And who owns the bishops? Rome. So really, who owns those lands? And it is an empire within an empire. And we need to be careful of that. Men have tried to prove that Constantine had given all these lands to Rome. The Lombards came and robbed them. And then now Charles is just winning them and giving them back again. But in fact, Pope Adrian I was supposed to have written and signed a letter to Charles in 775 explaining the gift of Constantine. But that was the letter that was later proven to be a forgery. That took place under Pope Adrian in 775. More was yet to come. The alliance between the Pope and the Emperor was growing closer. And here is where we begin to see why it is called the Holy Roman Empire. On Christmas Day of the year 800, Charles was worshiping in the Church of St. Peter in Rome when, as though on sudden impulse from God, Pope Leo III approached the Frankish king and put a crown on his head and then led a huge gathering of people to proclaim him to be as Caesar and Augustus, a title that had been forgotten for hundreds of years. So now the emperor and the pope wore the two titles around which medieval history revolves. They mutually compete with each other as the world king and the world priest. Now, it's hard to believe that that was an extemporaneous, unplanned thing, because the crowds were so quick to respond with that shout, as Caesar and Augustus. And Charles agreed to it. The Pope just happened to have that day when he was there in the church a crown in his hand. And so he crowned him. And the king is reported to have said later that if he had known that that was going to take place, he wouldn't have gone to church that day. But as a matter of fact, we do know that one of his counselors, a man named Alcuin, had urged the king to request that. And they had discussed it prior to this. There are too many indicators that it had been thought through ahead of time. Yes?
This is still Charles V, same Charles.
This is Charles, yeah. There are seven factors contributing to the strengthening of the papacy and the establishment of the Holy Roman Church here. The first, the working relationship with the Franks. That's where his protection was coming from. And he needed that. The Pope needed that. the king of the Franks needed to be crowned, and the Pope needed the protection. Cutting off of the relationships with the East. They could not get support and defense from Constantinople. The great donations of land to the Pope. The acceptance of the imperial crown from the hand of the Pope. The king accepted that. The visits to Rome by the king. And really his reverence of the Pope, his submission to the Pope. The very indefiniteness and the mystique of the relationship between the Pope and the king. The distance and the times involved in traveling from Northern Europe down into Rome. Now, we're dealing with something that's a very intangible thing. I'm trying to reach a word, and I asked two or three of you if you could get that word, and it still escapes me tonight. Maybe somebody else can come up with it. But when we drove into India, we saw the police and other officials in the uniform of the old British government with the pith helmets, and it was the empire, the British Empire, that was being, and there was a thought pattern that the people followed through with. In America, we were the colonists, but these weren't the colonists. These were more people of the empire. And the people of Europe had learned to think of the empire, the Roman Empire. People just did things the Roman way. It wasn't just the Roman language, but they just did things. And if the things were well organized, then it was Roman organization. And they just thought that way. So this was remaining in Europe. And now arises a churchman who has the blessing of the church of Rome. And yet people are still thinking the Roman Empire. And so there's that mysterious mystique of the Roman Empire that now seems to fit the Roman Church that is following along some of the same patterns. This is a little bit of what I mentioned the other day when Pope Gregory I, the first pope, sent Augustine with 40 monks up across Europe to invade Britain, where just a few hundred years before that, the emperor of Rome had sent the Roman legions up through to invade Britain. And they'd gotten up as far as Hadrian's Wall, maybe a little further than that, but then they were only there a few hundred years, and then they came out. But now, here at the time when the Roman Empire was just in pieces, the Augustine and his 40 popes, his 40 monks, are marching in to conquer Britain in a way that the Romans never did conquer. And part of the reason for all that was the fact that this mystique was there, that they were used to being thought of as being part of the Roman Empire. And now they were being thought of as being part of the Holy Roman Empire. All right?
Would you explain what impact the distances and travel times have?
Yes, it's going to mean more later on when... I wish, and I do have a lecture later where I'm talking about that, how long it took for a messenger to go from Rome to Britain. And things that were done in Rome, it was a long time before they got up to Britain or even to northern Germany.
But you've given seven factors contributing to strengthening the papacy and Holy Roman Empire, and you're saying the distance is strengthening it, but was the Roman roads, the improvement in transportation has strengthened the first Roman Empire?
Yes, yes. The people up here did not know what a horrible condition Rome and the Roman Church was down there. And the people down there weren't telling them They were rather showing them a very disciplined group of monks and a very disciplined way of living in the convents and in the monasteries. And later on, we're going to see how that had a lot to do with the feudal system was still in effect, and it went into and it stayed in effect throughout these medieval years, these middle years. But in that feudal system, the lord of the lands owned the people. They couldn't marry without his permission. They couldn't bury without his permission. They went to war on the basis of his word. They did this or that, and he controlled everything. And judicial decisions, justice was rendered by them. But gradually, these judicial decisions were sent down to Rome, which claimed to have the right to make even civil decisions, criminal decisions. The people who could appeal their cases to Rome usually got down there and find there wasn't any witnesses against them. And they could buy their own justice that way. And Rome was quick to realize that this was a way of bringing civil control to the far-flung parts of her empire. The Roman Church did. And so they were quick to make those decisions. That's one way in which that distance became an important factor in building up the strength of the Roman Church down there. The witnesses, somehow or other, never quite got down to the point of the trial itself. And the popes claim more and more authority insofar as the rendering of decisions. Does that help, Tom? We'll hear more about that when we hear about the rise of the papacy. The idea of a one-world kingdom, they taught, was supported by Daniel in chapter 2 and then in chapter 7. They taught that it was taught by Moses and by David and by Constantine. The world, they said, had caught a glimpse of a one-world kingdom. Byzantine emperors of the East, 320 years earlier, had forfeited all right to such a union of church and state when a girl named Irene killed her own son in order to get to the throne in Constantinople. And maybe we can take a little bit of that up, but that's a fascinating chapter out of the history of the throne in Constantinople. Both the Pope and the Emperor gained from these new relationships. And the mysterious intrigues and deals between the Pope and the Emperor throughout the years only contributed to the authority of each one. So that Luther, for example, and others could hardly tell who it was that he was answering to or dealing with. Was he dealing with the Pope or was he dealing with the Emperor? Was the Pope carrying out the authority and the decisions of the Emperor or was it vice versa? Let's look now at Charles the Great, Charlemagne, who was born in 768 and died in 814. I think my dates are right there. There's another date that I have, 742. But he was emperor anyhow from 800 to 814. The title, Devoted Protector and Humble Helper to Charles the Great. He was the foremost political man of his times, Charles the Great. And people compared him, and rightly so, with Julius Caesar or Alexander the Great. His kingdom reached from the Netherlands through part of Russia, clear down through Spain, and back again through South Europe into Italy. We're talking about Charlemagne. He really was the Great. He was foremost in physical strength and skills with weapons. Charles Magne, M-A-G-N-E, was the Latin phrase that was given to him because of his physical prowess. He spoke Latin and he understood Greek. And his most cherished desire was to rescue all the remainder of the Greek and Latin civilization, Christian theology and learning. His desire to found schools and to build cathedrals and monasteries was just unstoppable. His strongest convictions lay in the direction of the Christian church as being the base of all true culture and education and civilization. He set out to restore church discipline and to stop the barbarian invasions by himself becoming the aggressor. He tried to force Christianity on the barbarians, to Christianize them, all that he had conquered. The book he loved to have read to him as he ate at his meals, and it was a practice, was Augustine's City of God. That book determined the course of his life more than any other book. And incidentally, Donald was in here just a little bit ago. Donald is fascinated with the City of God. Augustine's book. And he's going to give us a report on that some of these times. But Charlemagne was nicknamed to his closest friends King David. He did have a knowledge of Scripture. His whole life was devoted to the purpose of bringing about the kingdom as he saw Augustine having written it. Many of his accomplishments live beyond him. The school, the University of Paris, which is still there today. There were some very serious weak spots in his character. There's an old Chinese proverb that says, better is a diamond with a flaw than a pebble without one. And it might well apply to Charlemagne. He had weak spots in his character. He was cruel and savage. He's known as being a butcher sometimes. At the time of the Saxon Revolt, he just butchered people. He had many wives. Used to consecrate him or canonize him. And then when Paschal III, one of the popes, did later on canonize him, the church proceeded to uncanonize him. But by what right did he get the title Lord of the World, Emperor of the Roman Empire? By the right of the Pope? But what right did the Pope have to take an empire away from the Greeks and give it to Caesar? By the right of acting from extemporaneous direction from God, what they had done down there in St. Peter's Cathedral, and that was the crown that he was wearing. By the right of the people of Italy, those were the Roman people. Maybe they were the most Roman, but they were just the people of Italy. What dangers that title was filled with. Within 500 years, Pope Nicholas I declared the crowning of the emperor was the Pope's giving to him the position and authority. And so, if the Pope had given him this, then what the Pope had given, the Pope could one day take away. He could ungive. He was not elected on the basis of the people. Could he be dethroned? And if so, who would have to do that? Who must swear faithfulness to him? Was the Pope his vassal? Or was the king the vassal of the Pope? Who must swear faithfulness to whom? He insisted that no man could become Pope unless he authorized it. These Pope emperors, the relationships, are very, very much an important part of the struggle throughout the medieval years. This was the Roman Constitution. And there's so many unanswered questions that it's not surprising to find German armies again and again during the Middle Ages marching down into Italy to force the coronation of a pope. That's what I'm leading to. I want you to see how those things work out. Or the pope to crown a particular king. We will have this man to be pope and we will force that by force of arms. Or we will have this man to be king and we will force the pope to crown this particular man. Over and over again, the swords of the two of the state was right, and the sword of the church was wrong. And the question is, which was which? That's the struggle we're going to get in, and we'll see more of that in the next session. I had hoped to get on into monasticism tonight, and we will have to pick that up for the next time. The Reformed Presbyterian Church has long been particularly interested in the subject of church-state relationships. And we really have to get back into these relationships where they began before we can understand what's involved in that. One of the things that I'm particularly thankful for is that William Symington, in his book Messiah the Prince, has laid a theological foundation for the relationship between church and state. And the one that I do not find any others. I could wish that Charles Colson, before he had written his book on the conflict of kingdoms or something like that, had talked with John Gerstner or some of the others who would have shown him a theological basis for not saying some of the things he did say, which are real blunders, and for taking some of the things he did say a lot further than he took them. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah. Some of the states were actually had their own established denomination, and I guess one of the stories I've been reading about Washington recently is when he turned in his, instead of when the king accepted the crown from the pope back in the early century, Washington had that same chance.
Yeah.
And he turned it down, and that sort of like took us away from the church-state relationships. It almost mirrored it up until that point.
What happened back there in 800, the year 800, on the Christmas Day, was the very thing that Washington did not do, and I never thought of that before. But he had been offered the crown, and he just would not, he did not accept that. It wasn't the church that offered it to him, but I still believe that Pepin knew that was coming. And Charlemagne certainly knew that it was coming when he pleaded for it. He demanded it, actually. All right, let's finish a little early this evening, and we'll pick up where we left off tonight next week. Father in heaven, bless us as we would make these applications and we would see how it is that you are developing a relationship between church and state. God, I'd pray you to help us to see how in the face of normative history and the relationships that you've described between church and state in your book, how there were those who sinned in medieval times and how you acted because of that. But God, bless us as we would not make the same mistakes that others have made and as we would evaluate everything that we do on the basis of what you've said in your book. We pray this blessing in Jesus' name. Amen. Any of you who are interested in that study mission to Scotland next spring, please let me know as soon as you will.